broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Welcome to the podcast as part of RN Huddle, produced by the University of Nebraska Medical Center and co-produced by the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel. I'm Joyce Black. I'll be your host for this session. My guest for this session is Dr. Susan Salmos from Chicago, and she's going to talk about a significant problem in healthcare, and that is pressure injuries from medical devices. So I'm going to have Susan introduce herself right after I tell you what's in the mailbox. So there's a question in my mailbox that says, we had a patient a year ago that we know had a stage 4 pressure injury. The patient went home. We haven't seen the patient for quite a while. When he comes back in, now the pressure injury has almost healed. And so to us, it looks like a shallow stage 3. How do we stage that thing? Well, the NPIAP came out with a position statement a number of years ago in which something called backstaging was not advised. And so backstaging would be where a stage 4 healed and became a 3 and healed and became a 2, healed and became a 1. That system doesn't work because the body doesn't replace missing muscle and fat and tendons and ligaments. And so once the ulcer is a stage 3 or stage 4, it is always a stage 3 or stage 4. Simply said, now to be in the healing process or closed once it's finally covered with epithelium. So the wound that you know was a stage 4 last time the patient was in, even though it looks like a 3 now, is still a healing stage 4. The interesting piece of the story is, what if you didn't know it was a stage 4? What if you didn't have that patient a year ago? Then you have to stage it the way you see it. So then it would be staged as a stage 3. So that's the mailbox today. Let's move on to medical device pressure injuries. I'm going to ask Dr. Salmos to introduce herself and tell us a little bit about the work that she did looking at medical device injury of the face. Dr. Salmos, please introduce yourself to the listeners and a little bit about your professional background and then the study that you did.
Hi, I'm Susan Salmos. I'm a August 2023 graduate of the University of Nebraska Medical Center with a PhD. And during that time, I was also the manager of nursing clinical services at the University of Chicago Medicine, where my focus was preventing pressure injuries, both those from medical devices, as well as those over bony prominences. As part of that work, I was a routine member of the medical surgical value analysis team that would evaluate new products coming in. And part of what I did during that time was to subjectively assess any new devices that were recommended to replace current devices, such as BiPAP masks and other devices that were applied to the face and other areas, obviously, and see if I thought they had a greater chance of causing pressure injuries or a lesser chance, really subjectively looking at, were these devices stiff or more soft than what was currently being used.
So you bring up a really interesting decision point. That is the stiffness of the plastic. And I think all of us are aware that some of the plastics we put on patients are, you know, harder than a rock, in my opinion. You know, when you look at the stiffness or the flexibility of a Foley catheter compared to a Red Robinson catheter, very different feeling. And so the amount of pressure that would be applied to the skin from a stiffer product would be more likely, I think this is where you were going, would be more likely to cause harm. Do you have a sense of what percent of pressure injuries in that period of time were from medical devices?
It varied from year to year, but on average, about 40% of all of the pressure injuries that were tracked were secondary to medical devices. And then, you know, another 40% were sacrocoxygeal, and then 10% all other bony prominence areas. But about 40% were secondary to medical devices.
40% seems astronomical. The study that we did at the University of Nebraska a number of years ago was actually the same number, 38.5. And that was over 10 years ago. So what you're telling us is that we haven't made significant progress in reducing the number of pressure injuries from medical devices. I think I can draw that conclusion from the fact that your number matches our number published a number of years ago. Would you agree we're not making much headway?
I would agree. And I think as, you know, our patients become more and more complex, we certainly saw that during the COVID pandemic as well. We have more and more medical devices that are life-saving, but that are also a risk factor for device-related pressure injuries. So it's a complex issue that, you know, as we continue these life-saving strategies, it does require medical devices, and that increases risk.
One of the things that I'll admit to the audience I wrote a number of years ago was that when a medical device is placed, it should be moved or removed every day in order to reduce pressure and shear to some degree on the tissue. But as you're saying, not all of these devices can have that done. I know, of course, that there are endotracheal tubes that are sutured in place. So we have a bit of an unplayable lie here in that we have stiff plastics used and not able to move those plastics. So tell us a little bit about the study that you did.
So the study was really based on clinical observations and quality improvement. So what are the things that we're doing every single day to prevent medical device-related pressure injuries? What's effective, not what's not effective? And really collecting on a monthly basis, what are the medical devices that are causing those pressure injuries? And recognizing that for those patients in the critical care setting, they certainly have more devices in place than patients on a lesser level of care, but they tended to be the more stiff devices, subjectively looking at those. So as you mentioned, endotracheal tubes, as well as nasogastric tubes. So this study was looking at, from a bioengineering perspective, what is the mechanical stiffness of those devices? And the study was funded by the American Association of Critical Care Nurses, and we were very fortunate to have Dr. Amit Geffen and his team at Tel Aviv University agree to work with us on this study. And looking at those devices and taking cross sections of those, he and his colleagues in the lab were able to actually measure and quantify the mechanical stiffness of the devices. And they were devices that were applied to the head and neck that had led to medical device-related pressure injuries in patients at the University of Chicago.
So Dr. Geffen is an engineer, and in the study, he helped Susan by providing a number of relative stiffness of these various tubes. And so what were the stiffest plastics that he saw, Susan?
Of the stiffest plastics, the top three were the Salem sump, nasogastric tube, endotracheal tube, and then the NG tube that was used for feeding. So those were the three stiffest of all of the devices that were tested. And in terms of comparing that to the stiffness of the skin, it was so far outside of the range, the magnitude, that it's not surprising when we look at which devices led to pressure injuries, that those were the main ones that were factored in there.
So two of the three are nasogastric tubes. You said the Salem sump, which is used to draw out gastric fluid, and then turn around and you can use the same tube if you want to feed the patient. So you're not talking about the Dobhoff feeding tube. You're talking about using the regular NG tube as feeding.
I think yes, and the Dobhoffs as well. I think one of the challenges with the medical record and what is documented in the medical record is, you know, often we know which devices are in the supply room, but if you look at the medical record to try and determine which exact devices were on the patient for any given day. Sometimes that can be a bit challenging.
Yeah, anytime you tap into the medical record, you lose some sleep trying to figure out what you're actually reading. So you were looking at correlating, I should say, the stiffness of the tube using Dr. Geffen's data to the occurrence of a pressure injury from that tube. How did you decide if the tube, as I said a few minutes ago, was moved daily? How did you, because you clearly weren't there 24/7. So how did you make that determination?
Unfortunately, for the purposes of this study, we weren't able to make that determination. And it simply came down to the study period and the data that was being used at that point in time. There wasn't a place to document in the medical record that the tube was being rotated, that the tube had been changed, that it had been repositioned. But certainly part of the quality improvement piece of this that I think really lent itself well to the study is that tracking those outcomes over time, you saw a decrease in occurrences from the time prior to the protocols being put in place to the point where the protocols were put in place, and continue to see continuous quality improvement in that area.
Well, that's great. So you basically shone a flashlight on the story and said, we're looking at these tubes, and whether you document it or not, they do need to be moved or removed. So how much did you work with respiratory therapy on the endotracheal tube part of the story?
Respiratory therapy was certainly one of the partners that we worked with closely in terms of not just endotracheal tube, but BiPAP masks as well. So at the University of Chicago, the respiratory therapists were responsible for placing and fitting correctly all of the BiPAP masks. So they were involved in the development of our prevention protocols. And we also made sure that not just nurses had access to the dressings, the prophylactic dressings we were putting underneath these BiPAP masks, but they were also then accessible to the respiratory therapists in their supply room, working with them as well with the endotracheal tubes, and then partnering with anesthesiology. If you think about all of the tubes that are placed prior to a surgery, for some of our patients, those would remain after the surgery. So working with them on placement, as well as, you know, the providers that would be placing the trachs as well. So there's a lot of collaboration with a lot of different disciplines outside of nursing as well. And then certainly I've mentioned the partnership with supply chain.
You bring up just an excellent point that nurses over time have tended to own the problem of pressure injuries. Pressure injuries have been described as a nursing sensitive quality indicator, but there's more people in the story than that. And my work with respiratory therapy has been wonderful. They're very, very receptive to helping. I want to, though, ask you, how receptive was anesthesia? How receptive was the surgeon who put the trach in? How did you get past that bump in the road?
I think we have to start at the beginning and recognize that at the end of the day in healthcare, we're all here for the patient. And we come at it from various different ways, whether we're a nurse or an anesthesiologist or supply chain, we're here at the end of the day for the patient. So a picture speaks a thousand words. Showing pictures of the injuries, I'd always have data to back it up as well, but within those slide decks, like talking to anesthesiology, talking to respiratory therapy, it was both the data of these are the occurrences and these are the patients that are harmed by these occurrences, but pairing them with photos as well. And I think those photos of those devices and those device-related pressure injuries really help make the point of, they might be small in terms of centimeter size compared to, you know, a huge sacrococcygeal pressure injury, but they're significant in terms of the impact to the patient and the impact to the family as well. And I think that's always the ground that we should stand on, that shared understanding of that we're there for the patient.
Yeah, that's a beautiful philosophy. If you keep the patient in the center of the Venn diagram, you're not going to go too far off. Everybody wants the best for the patient. The other piece that you're describing, though, is pressure injury on visible body parts. So a few moments ago, you said even though these are small in comparison to a sacral coccygeal ulcer, you know, you wear pants. So the fact that you have a big dressing on your backside, well, unless somebody knows it, they're not going to see it. But a person who leaves the hospital, you know, comes in for particularly elective surgery and leaves the hospital with pressure injuries on the face, that's pretty hard to explain. And you can see not only an impact on body image, but an anger in the part of the patient that nobody told them that they'd have a wound that took away part of their lip or took away part of their nose. And so I think your study really tackles the big issue of, are these devices something that we should be looking at redesigning? I mean, where's that part of the story?
Well, I think we have to. You know, you described patients coming in that are missing part of their lip. There's also the population at University of Chicago, almost 50% of them are of an ethnicity that might have a dark skin tone, and those scars don't go away. So you're talking about somebody that has this very visible scar that is not going to fade over time like it will for, you know, if I were to get a scar with my very light skin tone. So if there's a way that manufacturers can redefine and redesign devices so that they meet the clinical need, but reduce the impact of harm or reduce the risk of harm, I think that has to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. I believe that the last time the Foley catheter was redesigned was 1933. So that's 90 years ago. They have added some things to it, but the design itself has not changed. What has changed is the size of the patients they're put in. If you're an old movie watcher, you're seeing women who wore size 2 and 4 dresses. Women today are wearing size 22, 24, 26. And the tube, its design, was never designed for a person of the size we're using it in. So I do think it's time to take the story to the manufacturers. I can tell the audience that is one of the things that the National Pressure Injury Advisory Panel is going to do, is try to rally around some of the manufacturers. And actually, we're going to use Susan's data because of the stiffness measurements that Dr. Geffen provided, combined with her clinical assessment of injuries from those same tubes, really makes a beautiful argument, not just for anesthesia or ENT or respiratory therapy, but makes a really good argument for the manufacturers also. So as we close this session off, Susan, what advice would you have for nurses that are listening as far as how to reduce those pressure injuries? They're not going to be able to change the manufacturer this afternoon. So what's your advice for them?
Well, it's probably not a surprise that I'm going to start with the data. So you have to know your data. If you're not collecting data on all of your pressure injuries, which bony prominences they're occurring on, which medical devices they occur from, if they're from medical devices, which location, you can't really identify plans to move forward to help patients to decrease these harms from occurring. So I think that should always be the starting point. And there's a lot of resources that are out there for device-related pressure injury prevention. I would point to the NPIAP guidelines in association with EPUAP, so those international guidelines. Start with the evidence, start with the data, start with exposing the fact that you have some issues that you need to work on, and then certainly move from there. If you don't have protocols in place, the article that we published has the protocols that are in there so that those could be used as guidelines if there's gaps within the evidence that you're seeing as well.
So Susan, do you think it would be logical to start someplace small, start on one unit, start with just a few tubes and sort of make your point? Because I don't want our listeners to think that they're working in an 800-bed hospital and starting tomorrow, all 800 patients are under this new protocol. So would you agree that starting small might get some momentum going for the hospital?
Yeah, I think that's essential. And thanks for bringing that forward. Certainly, I've worked at an 800 bed hospital, and there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of different patient populations. So once you know your data, then narrow it down, start piloting on one unit, which is what we did. We piloted on a couple different units. We got input from nurses, from providers, from respiratory therapy, continued to refine our protocols before we then started moving it out house-wide into other units. So you have to start somewhere, and it doesn't happen overnight either. It's a lot of work and a lot of analysis and a lot of gaining feedback, gaining insight, and changing as you go, which is continuous quality improvement.
Well, we've just heard from Dr. Susan Salmos about her study on the stiffness of the plastics used in some of the medical devices, particularly those that are used in the face. So the NG tube, the ET tube, the tracheostomy, those tubes. And not surprising, the stiffness of the plastic contributed to the pressure injury risk. But she didn't leave it at that. She actually made it into a quality improvement project where the nurses were introduced to a broader plan for change. And you brought the numbers down, started at 40%. And how did they end, Susan?
Well, you know, I think what we've uncovered is that medical devices, those percent stayed at about 40%, but we're finding more and more devices. So during the time from the study period starting through with the end of data collection for the study, which was 2022, adult trauma services were added. That brought in a large number of devices that weren't present at the start in 2016. So cervical collars, halos, all kinds of things. So as you continue to focus on medical devices, you learn that it's not just these kind of top devices that we're talking about, but really focusing on all the devices and how we can continue to prevent those. So the top five might change throughout that time frame, but it stayed fairly steady at about that 40% of all pressure injuries for medical devices.
Thank you for that. I don't want that to sound discouraging. What Susan's talking about is the more you look, the more you find. And so you've got to start somewhere. We're very pleased to have Dr. Susan Salmos with us for this podcast on medical devices, particularly looking at the stiffness of the plastic from some data from Dr. Amit Geffen, an engineer over in Israel. This is Joyce Black. I am going to sign off this podcast with my appreciation to Courtney Smith, who manages all the technical stuff so that I don't have to. And of course, appreciation to the University of Nebraska College of Nursing for their willingness to work with us as we produce these. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE. Or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.